Hello, everybody, and welcome to Staying Fit ODAT. My name is Miggs, and I'm your host. ODAT is an acronym for One Day at a Time that I picked up in early sobriety and something that's stuck with me every day since. Welcome to another episode of Staying Fit ODAT. My name is Miggs. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to be your host today. Just a friendly reminder for all of our listeners, please go ahead and help us out with a rating and review. It really helps out with the relevancy of the podcast for people that don't already know about us. It'll help pop up in their suggestions if they listen to similar style podcasts. And you never know when one of these stories might really just entertain someone or might really help save someone's life and really give them something that they need to hear. So please leave us a rating, leave us a review, hit those stars, type a few kind words. It really, really just helps us out a lot. All right, with that out of the way, I want to go ahead and bring in today's guest. Today's guest is someone that I've had the pleasure of sharing one of the many Facebook running groups that I'm in, specifically a sober running group, and someone who has been really awesome. And the conversation pretty much started off as some feedback a few days before a marathon when I was tapering, and, you know, just kind of turned into, you know, I want to hear a lot of this wisdom, experience, strength, and hope as well on the podcast. And that's pretty much where it went on. And now we have Scott. So welcome on, Scott. How are we doing today?
Good. Good. Awesome. Cold, a little chilly in central Illinois, but good.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we're definitely happy to have you. And you pretty much kind of gave out some of the first question. Tell us who you are, where you're from, if you want to share what you do for a living.
Okay. Well, I'm a retired journalist. I wrote for a newspaper for 32 years, and I did magazine writing for 25 of that with an outdoor activity emphasis. I retired in 2012. I did some other things just to fill in some time. But then during the pandemic, I got into studying with the National Association of Sports Medicine to get my personal trainer and group trainer and senior fitness specialization. I'm 71. So I started to work at the local senior center about a year and a half ago and train people, and I just love it. But yeah, that's pretty
that's
much
awesome. You definitely don't look 71. That definitely goes a lot to do with the things you're doing to take care of yourself these days. So
thank you.
You look awesome.
Thanks. Right. Thank you.
Let's start all the way back from the beginning. You know, let's talk about your childhood, you know, as far back as you want to go, as much detail as you want to go into.
Sure. So my folks were hardworking, working class folks, you know, came through the Depression, World War II. My mom was, you know, kind of a right-wing conservative, and my dad was a labor organizer. So we didn't have dinner at our house. We had debates with food. And it was a great place to grow up in the 50s and 60s, really, because we really, you know, hammered out the issues. My dad was a Marine sergeant on Iwo Jima. And for some reason, I was born with this idea that killing other people just it's not a good idea. World War II was an exception that I believe that had to be done, but Vietnam, not so much. So we were, you know, definitely on opposite sides of the debate on that until, you know, the war dragged on and Dad saw the same view of it that Walter Cronkite saw after the Tet Offensive. He crossed over and realized that it was a waste. And so, but we had a lot of, you know, head to heads. So he was a fine ethical man. He treated everybody very well, but he was, I believe, the victim of post-traumatic stress from Iwo Jima. And so when he came home, you know, he just didn't relate well to a couple of kids. He had one kid before he went. He gave up a deferred job. He had a deferred job. He didn't have to go. But he had one kid at home, then came home and had two more. And he was distant. He was, you know, not very emotional, not very, he wasn't huggy feely. He was what you'd expect from a master sergeant in the Marine Corps who'd been on Iwo Jima. So I needed a hug. Every kid needs a hug, right? And my mother was right there, but a boy needs a dad. And so he was, kind of emotionally absent, let's put it that way. And unfortunately, I took that, as many people do, that there was something wrong with me. And so I tried really, really hard to get his attention, right? I starred in baseball. My mother was always in the stands, cheering me on. He never came. I would go past him as he drank his Falstaff, quart of Falstaff, reading his novels, to get some peace in his life, as I now understand. He drank a lot. I would go out and do my best to hit home runs, and baseball became a way of trying to get his attention instead of something that I really wanted to, really enjoyed. And I love baseball, but then it turned into this, like, I'm going to make you read about me in the paper tomorrow and wish you'd been there. Right. But he didn't come unless my grandfather, his father, wanted to come see me. And then he had to bring me, he had to bring his dad. So there's something wrong with me theme kind of played over and over and over. Right. So I carried that into, coaches. I needed coaches to pat me on the back. And I had, good coaches at times, but I had awful coaches too, as kids do. And the belittling kind, even no matter how good you are, you aren't good enough. And the same thing in school. I tried to excel in school and did really, really well. But in part to take home the report card to get, my dad's attention. But I never got told that that he loved me, never got told that he was proud of me. And same thing with women, girls, and then women, always trying to think that there was something wrong with me, always. And then trying to cover that up with, being tough and trying to, act like I didn't care, and, dying inside along about the age. So I was filled with this horrid angst and all these voices in my head. You're not good enough. You're not good enough. You're not good enough. I mean, they were constant too. They tell me that we're bombarded with somewhere around 60,000 thoughts a day. And, in alcoholism, we tend to, treat negative thoughts like Velcro and positive thoughts like Teflon. They just roll off, but the bad ones, they stick, right?
Unfortunately.
And so I had these voices just constantly just telling me what I wasn't good enough. And this reinforced by the church. My dad was a labor organizer, and so he organized truckers. And he and mom would go down the street and drop me off at the church on Sunday morning, because the truckers were all in town on the weekends, right? So they would all be down at, the church of Snyder's Tap. And so they would go down there while I was dropped off at church, and church would tell me, well, you were born into sin and you're bad. So, it was all these voices saying that, oh, you're terrible. And then, of course, I opposed the war. I was 12 and 13 years old when I was involved in my first underground newspaper. And, we were anti-war and pro-civil rights and a lot of things that you just weren't in a small Midwestern town. And so we turned it on its edge, got a lot of negative feedback from that. I had a Boy Scout I had a Boy Scout leader call me at home one evening and say that they were going to destroy my records so that I would have never existed as a Boy Scout. But anyway, that kind of stuff, you know, weighs on a kid. And so along about 16, my folks took a vacation and they made the mistake of leaving me at home. And because I was working. And some friends found out my folks were gone, so they came over, of course, and we went out and divided up and in search of some beer. And I'd had beers at home with my folks. They allowed me to drink at home. They encouraged it, because they would rather I drank at home than be out and about. So these guys and I, we all scored a lot of beer. And the next thing I know is I'm in a chugging contest with this guy I grew up with, and blackout, and I passed out. They stole my dad's car that night and they wrecked it. And I ended up having to tell, I was put in a position of either being a stoolie or telling a half truth to my dad, which I told him I wasn't driving the car when that happened, which I had hoped would be enough for him to, trust me. But, that was always a rift between us. He always thought I'd lied to him and I hadn't. So anyway, my drinking career never got better. I blacked out the first time that I drank. So, blackouts didn't seem like that was such a big deal, right? I mean, I thought it was just part of the deal. Everybody
blacked out. How easy was it to get the booze? Because if my math is serving me correctly, I mean, we're talking like late 60s, early 70s, somewhere around there.
Mid 60s. I graduated high school in 1969. So this was probably about 1966 or 69.
So what was it like for a teenager trying to get it? Was what was society like for teenage drinking back then? Like how were I know the drinking and driving isn't necessarily okay, but like how was society viewing a bunch of 16-year-olds, drinking and getting a car?
Good question. So I grew up in this town that was like 16,000 people. And it was the major employers. Well, we were in the middle of farm fields, so that was rural. But we had two major glass factories in town, and they employed 3,000 people. And so they were shift workers. And I've worked at the factory too. So it would be 3 to 7. I'm sorry, 7 to 3, morning to afternoon. Then 3 to 11 and 11 to 7. So you were on a shift that would go in 1 week at 7 to 3, the next at 3 to 11, and the next to 11 to 7. And in the meantime, you'd only get a couple of days off. So what that meant was downtown was always Friday night. It was some shift, a quarter of the town was off every night. So okay. So we had strip joints and gambling and all kinds of stuff going on downtown every night. We had as many bars, more bars, like 70 or 80 bars, I remember them counting up, in a town of 16,000 people. Wow. And these are people that are working this swing shift. So nobody's ever getting any good sleep. They're having to drink to go to sleep, and they're taking pills to go to work. So this was a very, very rough town, very rough town. And booze was really easy to get. As a matter of fact, there were four of us that night, right? We divided up into two teams, and we spread out with the hopes of getting a case. And we both came back with two cases.
Oh, wow.
All you had to do was be able to walk into a bar. I mean, we walked into a bar, and we asked for the beer, carry out. Paid for it and walked out. There was never a question of whether or not we were too young. Never. So then we took it home, and that's where we drank. And I felt I went into a blackout, passed out. They put me in bed, stole the car, and then the rest is history. So it was pretty wide open. Let's put it that way. And DUIs were, slaps on the wrist. You got fined. That really didn't start ramping up until in Illinois anyway, that penalties started ramping up in the 70s, and I started reporting. I was a crime reporter in the 80s and early 90s, so that's when it really started getting more serious in terms of, you know, bringing down the BAC and raising up the punishment. But
yeah. So what was it like, you know, the next day after you're waking up, you have a blackout, you're waking up with probably your first hangover, whether you realize it or not? What a lot of people really have, you know, it's really 50-50, you know, a lot of people that are on here, you know, they say, oh, well, I loved it and I couldn't wait to do it again. And then you have the other half of the crowd that's like, oh man, I felt like shit and I'm never doing that again, blah, blah, blah. You know, and obviously, spoiler, if you're on this podcast, you didn't never do it again, clearly. But you know, that's how people's mindset is after the first time a lot of times. So which one were you on? Were you team can't wait to do it again, or team I'm never doing this again? And then just find out you're wrong.
Good question. I was on a team, I'm not doing it again for a while. Because I was afraid of repercussions. I wanted to go to medical school then, and I was trying to get a medical school scholarship, and which I did, and gave up when I was in college in order to go into social work and community organization and fight, you know, the fight for democracy. You know, so so I was afraid of that this was going to really put a damper on all my future hopes. And so I stopped. I drank again. I went back to drinking at home with the folks and a beer when I got home from the dance, you know, but I didn't mess around till New Student Week at the University of Illinois, which I don't remember much of, except that REO Speedwagon was playing in one parking lot and Head East was playing in another. That's all I remember of the week. So then I was turned on to marijuana before probably the end of the first month, and took my first of many, 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 many trips on LSD within the first 6 weeks. I mean, it was after that, when I was away from home at college, it was Katie by the door, you know, and it was,
Wow. So you dove right in. As soon as you went to college, it sounds like you just pretty much dove right in right away.
What I did was, I was periodic. I would, you know, work my ass off during the week and to get the grades. And then, you know, Friday, my class schedule was always set so that I was off by noon. Noon, I was done. And then, so, you know, Friday at night was a blur. I studied Saturday. Saturday night was a blur, you know. So it was one of these, you know, real intense kind of, you know, study, 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 work real hard. I deserve this kind of thing. And I had never had control over drinking. I didn't know that there was such a thing. I didn't know you worried about such a thing. I used to drink Ripple wine out of a glass flower vase. I'd pour the whole bottle in and I'd drink the wine, and then I'd pour another bottle in and drink that wine. And one of the nice things about LSD was that, you know, a lot of times it was cut with, you know, a bit of an amphetamine. So, you know, you're up and you can drink wine all night. So, you know, it was, you know, and in there I was also, you know, there was this need to connect with something, because I wasn't able to connect with my folks, my mom, my dad, and I wasn't able to connect with women in a real way. I always felt less than. I never felt good enough, and so that alcohol and that drug intake would wipe that out for a while. A lot of people say, well, they drink because they wanted to fit in. I knew I didn't fit in. I didn't know how to fit in. I drank and did drugs, so I didn't care. And then LSD came along, and LSD was this thing that, you know, Life magazine, you know, tune in, turn on, drop out, you know, and connect with God, you know. And that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to connect with the spiritual. I had this need. I would never have put it in these words until AA, but I had this need to connect with a power of some kind. And that had been true since the earliest days when my folks were dropping me off at that church, was that I'd go in there and I'd hear about this guy that they said, you know, let the little children come to me, you know, he seemed so kind and so accepting, and I wanted to connect with that thought that they had. I could never buy the resurrection. I could never buy virgin birth. That was another reason I was always on the outside, right? Because if you want to be Christian, you got to buy that. Well, you know that. So I couldn't buy that, but I wanted to connect with that feeling, that sense of spiritual connection. And LSD kind of opened. I would never suggest this to anybody, but LSD kind of parted that curtain, and then it would slam shut. You know, 8 hours later, it slammed shut. And I'd feel that much more disenfranchised, that much more distant, right? Like, this isn't working either. But I keep trying and keep trying and keep trying. So frustration. Remember the big book where it says terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair? Man, they might as well stamp the word alcoholic on my head. That was where I lived. That was my address. Hell, that had been my address since I was, you know, 12, 13 years old. So,
I also want to point out too that you brought up something funny. You know, Monday through Friday, you did well, and then you started tying it on right as soon as you were done Friday. You were, some might say, you were a weekend warrior before people probably even knew what that term was. You know, I don't know if they were using that term back then, but I know that's something you hear now, and you were definitely probably one of the original weekend warriors.
I was doing what my dad did, right? You know, my dad worked. My dad really, really worked hard. Functional alcoholism.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I worked really, really, really hard. But then, you know, leave me alone. You know, leave me alone on those weekends. You know, don't make me. I don't want to go to any band concert. I don't want to go to any baseball game. I don't want to. You know, I want to be left alone with my quart of Falstaff and my, you know, my John LeClair novel.
I wish I didn't understand, but I do. And, yeah. You know, it's one of those things. I definitely get it. I'm told, I never seen the behaviors, but I'm told that my grandmother was also a weekend warrior. Monday through Friday, she worked in like a sewing factory or something like that. And, you know, her work week for 5 days, she just went home, didn't do anything. But the minute she clocked out on Friday till she went to bed Sunday night, I was told she was pretty much at the bar all weekend long. And you know,
and restless, irritable, and discontent in between, right?
I can only imagine.
Yeah, and then what happens, of course, is that, you know, Sunday, the weekend usually ends on Sunday. Well, then it starts ending on Monday. It starting on Thursday, and you know, then Tuesday and Wednesday are pretty soon bad. You're drinking every day, taking drugs every day. Dr. Bob, you know, when I read Dr. Bob's story, you know, that was my drug addiction. Dr. Bob was a drug addict. He used sedatives to get through the weekdays, and then he'd drink at night. And that, you know, so when I read that, I said, you know, that's me. That's what I was doing, is that I was using drugs to survive during the week, you know, so that I wouldn't get into big trouble. I'd smoke dope on my police rounds. You know, I can't imagine I didn't reek of marijuana, but you know, I got along with all the cops, and I was a good reporter. And so, you know, they kind of put up with me, I think. they never told me that, but I think that's what the case was.
Yeah. They probably didn't care about it as much back then either. You know what I mean? Even now, it's like they probably didn't care back then. Right now, when it comes to weed, they don't care as much too. But there was that really rough, like in between 20 or 30 years where, you know, I personally don't smoke weed anymore, but, you know, there are a lot. I'm not encouraging it for anyone by any means, but there are a lot worse things that people could be doing than smoking weed. Like, I personally even think alcohol is worse than weed. But, you know, again, these are just personal views. But, you know, I think a lot of cops, even today, even years ago before it was necessarily legalized everywhere, I think a lot of cops realized that. And, you know, it's just, I think they pick and choose some of the battles. It was like, I can bust this kid for this. I can get him in a lot of trouble, but good chances are he's going to try something else or, you know, do this and that. And it's like, yeah, maybe it could be worse. And again, I'm not encouraging it, but that's, I could imagine that's probably what a lot of police officers were thinking too. And it's probably no different than you. It's like, this guy could be doing worse things. If he smells like a little bit of weed, it is what it is. You know, he's doing his job, you know, what can you really do? And I can imagine society's probably a lot different back then too. You could have probably smelled like booze and they probably wouldn't have cared if you were doing your job the right way.
You know, newspaper reporting is kind of half art, half skill. You know, it's writing, and you really have to be good at being able to collect information. And so there's an art, and then there's a skill to it. And so the artist part of that is that, you know, the newspapers were pretty accepting of, you know, there were a lot of alcoholics working at the newspaper. There were a lot of people that were drinking too much and a lot of people that were doing drugs. And, you know, it's kind of that kind of a permissive at that time. It was kind of that permissive kind of atmosphere. So I never got in trouble at work over it. I never, ever. And that included some days when I would stay at home. Not very many. I was never, ever sick much. We got like 5 sick days a year. I never took them. But a couple of days a year, boy, I'd be at home, you know, just angry about something and drinking over it, drinking at somebody. You know, that can't go on. And, I got married to a woman that I proposed to on the third pitcher of beer, which is something that I don't recommend to anybody. And she had a couple of daughters who were at the age that they still thought that their father would come back into the picture. So I was like an interloper. And so, they made life pretty miserable for quite a while. So eventually, and we lost a couple of kids in pregnancy, which didn't help any because my mother was giving me this, you know, you got to have children so that I have grandchildren stuff, the pressure, which is why I ended up proposing on the third pitch. But that didn't work out so well. We lost 2 kids in pregnancy. So, you know, that. Shortly after that, the grief and the grieving way grief works in a situation like that, the couple tends to go through the grieving process differently and at different times, and things can communication can get haywire, and especially when it wasn't very good in the first place. So I ended up leaving that marriage. And 2 years later, I was suicidal, and because I couldn't connect with anybody. If you read the bedevilments in the big book, you know, that was me, you know, not unable to have relationships with anybody, that kind of thing. But I held on to the work, you know, that's what I am, is I'm work, you know, and I'm really good at what I do. So I define myself by my career, you know, and as long as I could do that, I'm not that bad. But then, you know, something happened October 1st of 1988. I got up. I was going to go fishing. I loved fishing but I had gotten so sick that the weekends had gotten to the point where I couldn't go. I just was too sick to go. I was too angry, too depressed, too whatever. And so I, you know, stayed at home, drank and smoked a lot of dope. But this day I was going to go. This day I was going to reclaim that part of me. And I woke up and it was raining. So nature was working against me. Why? You know? And I went into the bathroom and there was a little leak from the toilet bowl, the toilet tank, you know, a little leak. And I decided that I was going to fix that damn thing. Now, I'm the guy, I'm the guy that they always send to lunch if there's anything to be done with a hammer or anything, any fix-it thing, they always send me to lunch because my dad never taught me a damn thing about any of that. So in about 6 hours later, that toilet was smashed. It was broken, smashed. And I went out on the phone. Yeah, I'm high. And I went out on the phone. I was angry. Oh, my God. And for some reason, I decided to call home. And I called my father, and he laughed when I told him the story. And I'm sure it was funnier than hell. But if he had been standing in front of me, I would have killed him. I would have gladly put a knife in his heart and then killed myself. But he wasn't handy, so I was going to kill myself. And I mean, I was serious. This isn't just some passing thought. This is the end. I cannot figure out life. I'm a high honor graduate from college, smart guy, you know, winning awards at my job, but I can't figure out how to live. I can't put it together. I can't find happiness. I'm done. And I had no clue on what to do next. And the only thing that came to me was the Robin Williams solution, the one that he took, you know, a belt, and a doorknob, and my neck. And as a police reporter, I was very, very well aware of how people did, you know, themselves in. So the only thing that stopped me were two things. One was, I realized my mother would just be wrecked. Her baby kills himself. She'd be wrecked. She would have never understood why. One thing. And she just never would have been able to put it back together, you know? So she would have lived out her life with that sadness. And that stopped me. And the other thing was my sister. She'd gotten sober 10 years before. And my last public drunk had been at my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, which my sister put together in her small town, which was about 15 miles from where we grew up. And I, of course, closed the bar. Everybody else had left, and I stayed. And then I went over to her house, and she and her husband, who was also in the program, were sitting there just smiling and feeling good. And I'm standing there trying to sober up so that I can drive 45 miles home down this interstate. And they're telling me, why don't you spend the night? Why don't you spend the night? And of course I'm thinking, no, I'm not doing that. I can do this. And so that image came back to me that day of them sitting there while I'm just this damn drunken mess. And so I thought, you know, maybe I'll go to AA. Tomorrow, maybe I can always kill myself later. Maybe I'll go to AA tomorrow. Now, I breezed through AA briefly. My ex had suggested it. Although, you know, the weird thing about that is that whenever I went drinking, she was always with me. And whenever I handed a joint off, her hand was always there to take it. So, but she thought I should get sober. So there was an AA meeting right around the corner from where we lived at the time. It was at the hospital, and on Sunday morning, it turned out it was one of the bigger ones in town. And I'd go over there. I went over there three Sundays in a row. Nobody mentioned daily meetings. Nobody mentioned the big book, and nobody mentioned the steps. You know, whether or not I was just not listening, I think that they weren't saying it. So I decided to try the marijuana maintenance plan. That did not work. Marijuana makes you thirsty. And I started drinking again after we lost the kids. After we lost the kids and I moved out, my drug dealer actually and I were out playing pool one night, and he says, "Oh, one beer won't hurt you." Well, then, you know, I was suicidal. So it did. It did. It did cause some harm. So he was wrong. So I decided to go to AA the next day. So I did. And I stole a big book off the table, actually. I stole this big book. It's a mess. It's the third edition.
What year was that?
It's the third edition.
What year was this?
October 2nd of 1988. That was I stole that book on October 2nd of 1988.
So and that book you just showed me is 34 years old.
Yes. Well, yeah. At least it's been in my hands that long.
Wow.
Went home together to that empty place that I was going to kill myself in. And I sat down and I opened that book up and I started to read it. And I saw myself described so well. And it was about the psychological aspects of alcoholism, the restless, irritable, discontent, the inability to get along with other folks, the resentment, the anger, the frustration, the finger pointing, the director of the whole show, you know, people not behaving the way that I wanted them to, people not doing what I thought that they should do. And my God, that was all me. When they said director of the whole show, they should have stamped that on me too. You know, they could have tattooed it on my arm. That was me. The beautiful thing about, and the tears are just rolling down my eyes now. I mean, just rolling down my eyes. Because I just come from a place where there was at least 100 people and they were laughing and just having a good, I mean, they were having a good time on a Sunday morning. And, you know, here I was, you know, crazy and suicidal. And so here I am at home and I'm reading the introduction and it says that we're 100 men and women, you know, who've recovered from a hopeless, seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And then I get into the doctor's opinion and I get into Bill's story and I get into We Agnostics and I get into more about alcoholism and how it works. And I started reading about the 12 steps and I thought, I did an inventory that day. I knew that I was the problem. I knew that I'd been causing my own suffering by requiring these other people to do what I thought that they should do. You know, the children dying, you know, why did that happen? You know, why? You know, all these crazy thoughts, you know, about, you know, the people would say God's will, you know, what I think, if that's your God, I just want to find him and I want to throttle him, you know? And it was like the ice melted, you know, you've heard that, you know, the cliche. And it was like, man, I can do this. I can recover. These people recovered. I am alcoholic, because then after I saw all this psychological stuff, then it was easy for me to look back to that night when I, you know, my first blackout and realize I never had control over alcohol, never had control. And that was, see, when you don't ever have control, you don't see it leave. And it was the same thing with dope. You know, one was good, two was better, you know, and I was stoned from the morning till night. I mean, stoned, 20 years. And
what's drinking, that saying? One is too many and 1,000 is never enough.
Oh yeah. No, it was never enough. And the drugs helped me actually moderate my alcohol intake. It was, you know, I could bank those feelings for, you know, and then moderate my alcohol intake, so I wasn't waking up in the morning and drinking and unable to hold a job and end up on the streets. You know, I was functioning by all this medication that I was taking in, alcohol and drugs. And you know, so since then we find that Carl Jung and these guys all you know, saw alcoholism as, you know, searching for God in the bottle. And, you know, that spiritual, one of them called alcoholism a low-level spiritual search. And it was me trying to connect with something, and, or trying to not care that I wasn't connecting with anything. You get it? Then I started going to meetings, but I only knew about the one, right? So I was going to one meeting a week and living with the big book. But that first day, by the way, I got up off my dead ass. It told me to go make amends. So I did. I got up off my dead ass, put that book down, and went up to the house that I'd left a couple years before, knocked on the door and waited for my ex-wife to come to the door. And I said, listen, you were right. I'm alcoholic. And I'm told that I'm supposed to make amends for the harm I caused. And I don't ever think I'll be able to repay you for all the harm I caused you. But know that I really, really want to, and I'm going to change. And, you know, tears are going down my eyes and tears are going down her eyes. So the next day I end up going in, it's Monday, and I go into work. And I take each one of my bosses into a room, and I had been hell, you know, throwing the newspaper when things were wrong in my stories, the editors had screwed up, or, you know, something had been changed, and it was just not the way that I wanted it, you know, all that crap. And I've been hell, you know, to deal with. So I took three of them into a room, each one individually, and told them I'd come to an awareness over the weekend that I was alcoholic, and that I was going to be the best employee that they have ever seen. And then I went and did my best to do that. I, you know, became a team player, became, you know, I realized that once I finished writing a story, if I push the button and it send it over to the editors, I'm done. I can't do anything about it. I quit reading my stories in the newspaper. I didn't even bother. I didn't do that for till the day I retired. So, because I had done my bit, right? I changed what I could change. You know, I had to accept everything else. So why bother getting involved unless somebody called and said there was some error and I had to check something out? But 2 years later, after that, I had been at the newspaper 8 years when I got sober. And 2 years later, it was my 10-year anniversary. And they always had this cake. They always buy you a cake on your 10 and 20 years. And so they call everybody in the newsroom. And at the time, we had about 70 people. So my editor gets up in front of everybody. And he says, I know two Scotts, one before AA and one after. And that was about, you know, as good as an endorsement of the program and the work that I'd done that I could have ever received, you know? So 6 weeks or so after I got sober, I was grabbing everything spiritual that I could find. The Power of Positive Thinking. I got into that whole, vein of Christian teaching and that kind of thing. And I was watching The Hour of Power. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but the Crystal Cathedral they were all very upper, you know, upbeat Christians, you know, love, you know. And there was a priest on there, and he was a guest priest doing a sermon, and he said a line from that was that he said, I was born with a need for love that only God's love could satisfy. And it was like, boom, you know, it was like, hi, hello. It was like, boom, you know, it was like, that's exactly what the 12 steps are about. It's about finding this God's love that, of a power greater than myself. People call him God, whatever. I don't, that's not where I'm at all. But I was born with a need for love that only a spiritual practice could fill. And so, you know, it kind of sold me on the whole process of inventory, confession, restitution, prayer and meditation, and service. And so I set that as a daily approach to living that's, you know, served me ever since. It's brought about great joy, great happiness, great, I mean, I celebrate life every moment of every day. At least that's my intention. So, and when I get off the beam, the 10th step brings me right back. And and meditation is very, very important to me. I spend a lot of time in it. But so that's basically how alcoholism became a real jumping off point for me. It became a real trampoline, you know, way down and way up, you know. So I live in that place. I live on that pink cloud that I found, and my sponsor encouraged me to have my mail sent to, you know. Other people may say, oh, that pink cloud will disappear. Well, that's not so necessarily true. If you keep doing what you're supposed to do and accept things you can't change when they come along, and there's a lot of stuff in my life that came along that wasn't all that, you know, happy. But there's a joy even in that, isn't there? Being able to accept even the harshest of things that life can put before you, accepting those things, there's a joy in being able to do that. Because then fear, the book talks about, we commence to outgrow fear. And don't we indeed do that by developing this sober resume, you know, of things that come along that we are able to greet and meet, and not only greet and meet, but turn them into great assets. Because I can come on a podcast like this and say there is absolutely nothing that you need to fear, other than that thought that I can drink again. That one we don't want. That one we recoil from. But I haven't had that thought since I got sober. So
I love that. And thank you so much for sharing that part of your story with us. You know, it's always mind blowing to me to think too. You know, I've publicly recently came out that, like, I reset my sober time. I haven't had a drink in 4.5 years, but I did reset my sober time. And, you know, I got a little over a year now because I also did the marijuana maintenance. But I also self-admittingly went through two stages. I went through marijuana maintenance in the beginning, which, if I'm being honest, I was still counting my sober time because, you know, depending on how you want to look at it, I at least justified it and felt that I was using it for almost like medical purposes, the same way a doctor would prescribe something else. And, you know, but then I got to a point where I was pretty much just using it recreationally. And I was like, this just isn't, it's not for me anymore. So I personally decided to reset my time. You know, what other people decide, that's their business. Like, I'm not against MAT, you know, whatever the case may be. Someone's own clean time is for them to decide, you know, how they're going to determine it. That's the same way. It's not my business to call someone else an alcoholic. It's not my business to determine how long someone is sober based off of what they are or are not doing. But with that said, you know, I definitely identify with a lot of the stuff you were saying there. But the mind blowing part to me is, regardless of when I reset my sobriety date, I still haven't picked up a drink in 4.5 years, which to me is one of the biggest accomplishments I've ever made in life. And I look at my son, who is only 16 days older than my original sobriety since the day I stopped drinking. And I like to almost like, I used to really look at my sobriety and be like, all right, it's this old now. My sobriety is now starting to talk. It's starting to walk, you know, it's starting to be a pain in the ass and it's jumping off of furniture. And like, that's the way it was growing. So when I look at someone like yourself, who has only been sober one less year than I've been alive, it's like, it's crazy to really think that, if you think about it that same way too, like, your sobriety has been through all of those stages, plus driving, plus getting drunk, plus getting sober, having children. It's like, someone with all of the things that someone can do in an entire lifetime, And it's like, and in that entire time, this guy found the rooms when I was a baby and hasn't picked up a drink or a drug since. And it's just, it's mind blowing. I love it. I love when I get a chance to talk to people who have been sober pretty much as long as I've been alive. It's just, I love it. Like, you've literally, you can literally say that you've learned more than some, like, you've forgotten more than some people even know yet. Like, it's literal, you know, whether you want to say that or not, because you seem like a very humble person that probably wouldn't say that. But the fact of the matter is, it's very true. Like, you've seen it. I'm also curious, for someone like yourself, are you still in the rooms today? Do you still go to meetings?
Every day.
All right. I'm really curious. You know, society was way different back then, you know, and I don't know so much in the 80s, but I know it was really big, you know, with the second A in AA, the anonymous part. You know, a lot of people couldn't or wouldn't talk about being in the rooms. They couldn't or wouldn't talk about. And it sounds like you might have been in a little bit of a different story, because even just based off what you said, your boss saying at 2 years, you know, when you were 2 years sober at your 10-year thing at work, you know, your boss even publicly saying in front of people, I know Scott before AA and after AA, a lot of people even in that situation might not even been comfortable telling people, or only told the boss and said, please don't tell anybody else. I just want you to know for whatever reason. What have you seen? What has it been like for you over the last 34 years or so, seeing how things were back then compared to like how they are now, where there's a lot of people like myself and thousands of other people that are like public and open about their sobriety and recovery to try and help other people? What is it like seeing that transformation for someone like you?
So my first sponsor for 10 years was a guy by the name of Tom V, just a wonderful man. He was a corporate guy. I live in the home town of State Farm. So there were a lot of State Farm executives that were involved in Alcoholics Anonymous here then. And for them, anonymity was incredibly important. So, but for me, here I am like a public person. My byline is in the paper, you know, several times a day. You know, people knew me just by name, you know, and so, and I'm around police all the time. I'm around firemen all the time. I'm around judges all the time. And so it was important. I mean, I realized right away that there was no way I was going to stay anonymous. And so I wanted it to come, if it came from anybody, I wanted it to come from me. And I wanted it to come out like it was matter of fact. I realized that I'm allergic to alcohol. I can't do that anymore. So I'm not. And, you know, there's a lot of people today who don't drink just for health reasons and don't do drugs just for health reasons. So it's much more common now. Sobriety is much more common now. We're not the only ones. So one day, I'll tell you a story. One day I'm over at the courthouse.
You know, it's a good one if you're laughing before you can even start the story.
Well, you know how it goes. I'm at the courthouse and I'm getting on an elevator. It's like after lunch and I'm getting on an elevator and the elevator opens up and there's like several of the judges that I work with, right? Several of the judges whose courtrooms I'm in and out of all the time, you know, and we're first name basis. I always call them judge, but they always call me Scott. I mean, I was first name basis. And there's this guy in this neck brace with his back to me. And I knew immediately who it was. It was a guy from the program. And he was a newcomer. And so he turns around and he looks at me as I get on in the elevator. And he says, are you still going to all them A&A meetings? And all the judges, they start to laugh. And the reason they started to laugh was I had given them big books. Because I had gone to them sentencing people to AA, and I wanted them to know something about what they were doing. And I also You know, they think they were being tough sentencing somebody to one meeting a week. I said, well, here, read the book and see what the program's all about. So they all knew I was in AA. And if they had questions about the program, they'd come to me. And that's how it should be. So what I hoped was happening, and I think has happened, is that the chill regarding the word alcoholic has started to thaw. I don't think that there's quite the societal condemnation of alcoholics just because you're alcoholic. My sister ran for school board. She's a very bright woman, has an advanced certificate in school administration. She was a high school principal, took over the family newspaper up in that small town my great-grandfather bought it into and took over and passed through. My sister got it when she got sober. And she ran for school board, and I was a community organizer, you know. I worked for McGovern, and I did a lot of political stuff. And so she was worried that it was going to come out. One of her opponents was talking about her being alcoholic. Well, by then, hell, she'd been sober 15 years. And so I said, well, if he brings it up, if he has the gall to bring that up in a public meeting, you just stand up and you say, yeah, I'm alcoholic. I haven't had a drink since such and such a date. Who can say that? Raise your hand. And just see what the audience would do. Because most of them are drinkers, right? Most of them are social drinkers. They couldn't do that. Her opponent couldn't do that. So alcoholic or not, I'm stone cold sober and you're not. So, you know, it just is that kind of, if we think that there's something wrong with us for being the recipient of an alcoholic gene that dates back to the, you know, caves when people first found, you know, fermented grapes. If we think there's something wrong, then other people are going to think there's something wrong. But there isn't something wrong. It's no more your or my fault. I didn't ask for it. Did you? I didn't. Anybody who asked to be alcoholic, raise your hand. I didn't ask for it. Just is what it is. And you know, the shame of it is not doing something about it. You know, when somebody hands you a big book and says, you know, millions of people have gotten sober this way. And for you to sit back and say, well, it won't work for me. Well, yeah, really? Maybe that's not the problem. Maybe it's not the book that's the problem. Maybe it's that you just don't want to. You can, and you can live very well and have a really great life. I have a wonderful life. You can have a wonderful life and be alcoholic and drug addict in recovery. You can have the most incredible life that you could ever imagine.
So true. So
actually,
true.
Alcoholism becomes a big gift in recovery. When we see, I'm sitting here and you're sitting here, and we're miracles. We're everybody out there's a miracle. Every living thing is a miracle. The cosmos conspired 14 billion years to make you and to make me. We're miracles just on that score, right? But then you add to it the alcoholism, and clearly we've touched a power that makes it possible to do impossible things. And so alcoholism becomes this wonderful, wonderful gateway to an experience of a spiritual presence, not just something that somebody preaches to you on Sunday, you know, God. We know, because if it weren't true, then I'd be dead. I'd be dead on October 1st of 1988. But here I sit. And so there isn't any other explanation other than I've touched in some spiritual power that makes the impossible possible. So it's a good thing. You know, yeah, I'm alcoholic and I'm in recovery and I have been since October 2nd of 1988. That is a miracle moment by moment. So if you have any doubts, if there's a power greater than yourself that you can tap into, the fact that I'm sober should dispel that, right? So that. being sober becomes a mission. It's not just for us. You know, they tell you, you got to get sober for you. Well, yeah, kind of. But I got sober for everybody that's come after, because I'm, and you are, the bullshit. We're the bullshit stoppers, because the bullshit stops. Well, I can't get sober. Well, yes. Why not? I'm sober. You can get, why can't you get sober if I'm sober? Why can't you get sober if Miguel's sober? Of course you can get sober. Do you want to? That's the question. Do you want to? So.
I love it. And it's so true too. I think addiction rates, you know, between alcohol and drugs, I think the addiction numbers are probably at an all-time high right now. But I think the stigma surrounded and the connotation behind the word just like alcoholic or addict or, you know, being in recovery, I think all of those, like the shame levels that come with them are at an all-time low, because yeah, people can just be open. And so I love that. You know, I wish the numbers weren't so high with the addiction themselves, but the fact that the shame is at an all-time low, I love that, because it's giving the ability to people more and more every single day to openly admit it and to ask people questions and do the things about it to make their lives better, rather than just sitting at home thinking they're alone, thinking they're the only one, or thinking that other people are going to, you know, hate them. People are going to judge, because that's just, unfortunately, the facts. That's the shitty world. You know, there are going to be people that judge, but there are going to be way more people that are going to offer help and offer a hand than there are going to be people that are that'll judge. So you just got to look past that first group of negative people and just go straight to the people that are going to help you, that are going to help you grow and better your life. With all that being said, you know, that's, I love all that so much. And I definitely now at this point, I want to jump into the fitness part of this podcast episode.
Oh, okay.
All
right. Great. That's
so
fun.
I know very little about your journey. Like I said, the only thing I know about you as far as fitness wise is that you talked to me a little bit when I was getting ready for the marathon, and you mentioned that you were a coach, which you clarified a little bit earlier on this episode about the NASM. So I don't know where your journey starts, though, whether it starts before or after you got sober. So start wherever you want to start.
Okay. No. I'm a USAT coach, triathlon coach, US Masters swimming coach. And, I've got a National Academy of Sports Medicine certifications and personal and group training with a senior fitness specialization that covers it. And, this is entirely, since 2005, I peaked at a 50-inch waist. Nobody gets on a scale that big unless they're forced. The last time I was weighed, it was like 373.
Oh, and how tall are you?
6 feet. Okay. So I was pretty big, and I think I hit 400. I was having health problems, of course, and I got married in sobriety, and to an Al-Anon, I'm not going to go too deeply into her story, but problems developed in terms of the program, how she was working it or not working it, and fell off on some mental kind of issues that she may have had. And so things got pretty dark, and I lived with that for several years, and decided to get in talking with my sponsor, you know, I was enabling somebody. And so I, like an alcoholic, somebody married to an alcoholic, you know, enabling them. There comes a time when you need to look at, maybe you need to draw back further. So I did. I offered to either somebody had to change, or, you know, let's separate and get a divorce. So that didn't go the way I'd absolutely hoped, but, you know, it was what it was. So I ended up getting a divorce. Well, here I am bashing it and working, you know, lots of hours at the newspaper and with no physical fitness going on at all. And I've been, you know, one of these people that ate and then lost a lot of weight and ate and lost a lot of weight all the way, all through life. And so this time I started to eat, and the next thing I know is, you know, I'm huge. And so in 2005, I made a resolution. I was going to lose it. I bought a bike and I went out with these young kids in spandex, and I'm, you know, in my 50s, late 50s actually, and or 50s, 54. I was 53 or 54. And I'm riding around in the country with these people on spandex and road bikes, and I'm on this big clunky hybrid trying to keep up, cussing like crazy. And finally losing some. So I lost a bunch that first year. And in 2006, I went to the doctor and I thought that he was going to tell me what a great job I'd done. Well, he did. And he also told me that, oh, the blood test came back and you need to go see another doctor. You need to rule out cancer. Well, it turned out I couldn't rule out cancer because I had it. And so I rode 17 miles the day of my surgery. And then went in and had surgery, and I got back on that bike just as soon as I could. And in 2007 and 2008, a friend of mine was raising money with triathlon teams, relay teams for Livestrong. So I rode the bike leg for a team, and we raised a lot of money. And I really fell in love with the people that were doing triathlon that, you know, and I felt bad because I'm racing by them, you know. They've already done the swim and I'm racing by them. I felt bad about it, you know? So I decided, okay, I wrote in the paper. I was writing in the paper all this stuff about biking and losing weight. And I had a column, so I was able to personalize things. And this coach called me. I put in there that I was going to do a full triathlon. And a USA cycling coach called me. He lived locally. Said that he thought that I was inspiring people and that he would like to be part of that. And so he volunteered to help me get through that first triathlon. And I hired him after that. And he was from Vision Quest Coaching out of Chicago, Robbie Ventura's group, and a great guy. And when we talked about goals, I don't know what made me say it. He said, well, what's your ultimate goal here? And I said, well, you think I could do an Ironman? I'm 57 years old now. And I said, you think I could do an Ironman? I almost whispered it. I didn't want to go on record, you know. The guy said, well, yes, Scott, but not today. So what we did was we came up with a 3-year plan to get me to the finish line of Ironman Wisconsin. And I did. I did it with a hernia I knew about. I had to wear a truss. I'd fallen and I had a hernia. So I had to wear a truss during the Ironman. I didn't even tell my coach that. And finished the Ironman and went to have that fixed afterwards. And the guy asked me, when's the last time I had a colonoscopy? And I said, well, never. And so he fixed my hernia and did a colonoscopy. And then he came out and he told my wife that I had cancer again. And he turned out to be wrong. It was a big tumor that was blocking my colon, but it wasn't cancerous. So I had 2 feet of that taken out. And I did Ironman Wisconsin in 2013 again. So it was 2011, 2013. I did it twice. And then I started, when I did Ironman Wisconsin the second time, I had a burning sensation in my hip. And it turned out to be a disease called AVN. And It's a circulation disease that costs that kills the bone. So I had to have a hip replacement. In rehabbing that, I did a couple of half Ironmen and then got involved in an ultra marathon up here that it was great. It was a trail run and it was 32, it was 50K, 32 miles. And I just absolutely loved it because it was, I was off the road listening to birds. People were great. So I got into that. So I've been up, I've done up to 100K, 62 miles last, this past month, October. And I was actually, I did it on October 1st. So I was supposed to do 100 miles. I got the 62 mile mark and the aid station 16 hours into this. And I was just so high and so happy. And I was celebrating 34 years of sobriety in about 15 minutes. And I said, you know, I've done enough. I'm farther than I've ever been. And, you know, I really didn't, it was getting a little dangerous for me. I had balance issues and I was running along a canal and I was afraid I was going to like veer over into the canal, which wasn't, you know, beyond the realm of possibility. So I said, you know, I've had enough. And so I've been up to 62 miles and got my during the pandemic, that's when I got the fitness stuff and I work at a senior citizen center doing personal training on group training 4 days a week in the afternoons. I run in the morning and I do the I work out with all of them. So I'm getting plenty of strength exercise. And having I really have a fun, I really have a ball with it all. It's really been a great life. I'm going to try and get back on the bike this coming year, trying to figure out what I want to do, but I'm going to get back on the bike and maybe do another triathlon of some sort, but we'll see.
That's just unbelievable. And we're going to have to, dissect a couple parts here, because that just went way too quick for me, because you threw a lot at us in a very short amount of time there.
Okay.
So wow, two, you've done the bike relay in triathlon relay, you did the bike leg in triathlon relays. You've completed two Ironmans. That's
Yeah.
insane.
Wisconsin. It's great.
It's
It's a beautiful course.
insane. What is it like training for an Ironman? I've been fortunate enough to ask this to a few guests, but walk us through the experience of training for an Ironman, because I think you hit on something that's so important. It doesn't really matter your age. Maybe for someone your age, at the, how old you were and whatever shape you've been at the time, I could see why a coach would say 3 years. But I think even someone who is in their prime peak of their fitness, and even we'll say like their 30s, because I really think the 30s is really when you're in your peak as far as endurance sports like that. It's not like baseball or football where you're like peaking in your 20s. I think sports like that it require endurance. I really think that men, at least specifically men, I personally think that we're in our prime in like our early to mid 30s. So even if we take someone who is in their prime, that requires probably at least a year of dedication to really take an Ironman serious. So what is it like that entire time training? Like what's going through your mind? How is it feeling? Are there times where you thought like, fuck this, I'm not even going to do this anymore? Was it ever a doubt in your mind? Like what is that 3 year buildup like?
So, first thing is, I married a woman in 2008. We went to high school together, but we never knew each other there. And when I got on the bike and I started writing about losing weight on the bike, she emailed me at the paper and said, "Oh, but can you help me pick out a road bike?" And oh, by the way, we went to high school together. So of course I looked her up in the hard scrabble my mother made me save. And I said, "Oh, I didn't know her." So I called her back and I said, "Well, let's go out for coffee." Well, we got married a year and a half later. And she, I knew I was going to marry her because one summer we went out and she did a century ride with me on one of the hottest days of the year when other people were just like falling over and throwing up. This woman finished, and I said to myself, I am marrying her. She is the woman for me. So thankfully she said yes. She'll tell you she didn't sign up for this, but it kind of creeped up. So first I'm training for these bike rides. Well, I'm just riding, a lot of bikes. She did too. But then I started to swim and I'm starting to do this other thing, get up in the morning and go off with the master swimmers over at the university pool. And then I'm starting to, I came home one day and said, I'm going to go for a run. She said, what? So I put on shoes and went out to see if my knees would hold up. And, I did a Galloway, and I ended up doing a 5K and getting into it that way. So, but she's been incredibly supportive throughout from all of this stuff. She's been right there. And you got to have that. You got to have the support at home because it's really it's my first, my coach Stan told her that this is going to be like a part-time job for him. So he's going to be working a full-time job and then he's going to be training as if it were a part-time job. And by the end of the peak training for Ironman, it's going to take you 20 hours a week. And so I'd come home, I'd get up, I'd go swim, I'd come home from work, and then I get on my bike and I go out and do my bike, or I go down in the basement and do it on a trainer, with the computer and all that. So I was putting in all kinds of time on the weekend, and she was right there with me. Did I ever think that I wasn't going to do it? The answer to that is no. There's a dedication that there's a mindset that comes with this. I never really put up when you're in recovery, you never really put up roadblocks. Everything.
Give me a minute.
Everything becomes possible, and so I never really second guessed it. It was just a matter of having the personal discipline to be able to do workouts, work, make sure that I was taking care of my responsibilities at home and AA. It was just a matter of arrangement.
Putting the puzzle pieces together.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's just been a great lifestyle. I mean, you have to think of recovery as a lifestyle. You can't think of it as a program. The 12 steps are a lifestyle. This whole thing is about moving away from habits that may be
coming, buddy. I'm coming.
That may be moving away from habits that may be self-destructive, and replacing them with habits that are positive habits and self improving. So there are 24 hours in a day. I don't sleep deeply since my first cancer. So 6 hours, 5 hours is a lot for me. I meditate in the morning before I get out of bed and all that. So it's just a matter of piecing things together. Personal management.
I can totally relate to the not getting the best sleep all the time, but just trying to do it when you can. So that's just, it really is just unbelievable. Everything you went through for the Ironman training. And like I said, I definitely identify with the whole lack, not sleeping as much as we should. I mean, that's pretty much the story of my life between working in a restaurant and my wife working and being in nursing school and having a 4-year-old here with us and wanting to get in my runs and my weight training at the gym and mental health. And, it's just so my sleep pretty much consists of like 3 and 4 hour naps when I can a lot of times too. Like, it's pretty much what I got last night. That's what I'll be getting in about an hour or two from now. I'll probably be laying down for like a 2 hour nap before work. That's pretty much, so I'm right. I definitely identify with the sleep thing. I wish I can get on a consistent schedule, but maybe when my wife graduates, we'll be able to work something out. What was, man, just so much to pack in here. What did you say your next long-term goals are race-wise? Is there anything, are there any races on the menu? Do you want to do anything specific?
November is my, this is an off season. This is when we're starting to put together goals.
Okay.
And I haven't figured that out. My goal had been to run 100 miles, but I'm having trouble with the balance. And that 62 miles was a lot. And Kathy was real worried about me, more so this time than she ever let on. I got home to tears, that she was so grateful that I quit. I don't know. I'm looking at maybe they have track runs, you know, for 24 or 48 hours.
Yeah.
And so you're actually inside a track an outside high school track or something. And so you're every quarter of a mile, you're at your car. You can get help if you need. I'm not sure. I tried to do it solo. You can't do it solo. You got to have a crew. You got to have somebody to pace you overnight. Somebody's got to remind you to eat and drink. That was another thing. I was more concerned about not falling. And so I started to not pay attention to what I was eating and drinking. I think that was part of the problem. I hit a wall, and it would have taken me too much time to try and put myself back together and continue on. I probably would have had to take a nap, and I really didn't have enough time at 16 and a half hours or so. I had 30 hours max to get done, and I had 38 more miles to go, and so it was going to be a push anyway. So I don't know.
The only suggestion I would have for doing the track run, and it's crazy too, because I think how much I probably would not enjoy doing a super, super long track run because you're just running in circles. But I'm also the same psycho that does 20-mile treadmill runs, and people call me a psycho.
Yeah. So,
you know, it's I get it. It's like people would probably laugh at me and be like, you think running around a track would be boring, but you're the same guy who runs on a treadmill for 4 hours.
Right.
So. Yeah, I guess to each his own. The only suggestion I would have with the track, and this is just what I've heard from other people who have done really, really long runs on a track, is just make sure that every so often you switch directions. Just because although it is a flat surface, when you're rounding those turns, you can't help but to lean on your left leg or your right leg, you get what I'm saying. You're a smart man. Based off which direction you're going, you're going to be leaning on that leg, you know, making all those left turns for hours at a time. So I've heard people say that you just got to make sure you switch directions. So that way you start recompensating to prevent any injuries that you might not necessarily feel during that run, but any longer lingering issues, just to recompensate and redistribute that weight that you're putting on your hips and your ankles as you hit those turns, especially when you're talking about 24 hours. You know, you're not talking about making that turn 10 or 15 times. You're talking about literal hundreds, you know,
400.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to just think about even just running a marathon, you got to make that turn 100 times. So if you start thinking 50 miles, 100 miles, I mean, you're making those turn hundreds. So
yeah, it'd be 1600, right? Yeah, 16. But during the winter, when it gets really bad, I usually run outside no matter what. But when it gets really bad, like the snow's deep or something, I end up at the gym, and they have a 1/12 mile track, and
Oh man.
I'm over there running 4 and 5 hours. When I was training for the 100 miles last winter, I'm over there running 4 and 5 hours on that track. So I understand what you're talking about. You got
That's
to
an indoor track?
Yeah, you got to be real careful about what you're doing. You got to be
Yeah.
real, real careful.
My gym has one of those too. It's I guess it would be if you got to do 13 laps. Yeah, it's a 13th mile track.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's crazy too, because I've tried to do sprints on it, but it's so, the distance is so short
Yeah.
that I feel like I can't even get sprints, because as soon as you actually pick up speed, you have to make a turn.
Yeah.
And I kept getting scared that I was going to hurt my knee or my ankle just like trying to decelerate, because I don't even get a, it just, it felt weird. So now
Yeah.
I only use that really short indoor track for like, just pretty much like if I do speed run on a treadmill, sometimes I'll do like my cool down on the track, just if I want to actually be moving and
Yeah.
actually feel a surface under me. Sometimes I'll do it,
Yeah.
or just to kind of walk around. I actually, what I would use those more than anything too, is the one gym I was at that had an indoor track. It had one of those, like, it almost kind of looks like a trap bar and kind of almost looks like a tire, and it had straps, so you can pretty much do like deadlifting with it. And I would just use that to walk around the track, because it was kind of like shoulders, it was like strength training, and it was like helping out with grip strength and whatnot. So you can just walk around the track a few times, and before you know it, you did like a quarter mile and you have that. And it was nice too, because it felt safe. If you just had to drop it, you didn't have to worry about losing anything. So I
Right.
like to do stuff like that, or walk around with kettlebells and whatnot too, again, to just work on the grip strength, the shoulder strength. I found out long term too, it really helps you out with like pull-ups and whatnot too, because you're really increasing the strength in your lats a little bit with that one as well. Man, this has been a lot of fun. And you know, I appreciate you too jumping in on a couple posts that I made too, to just pass on some experience and some wisdom. It really, really helps out. And you know, that's the beauty too, is that not everybody necessarily has to agree with any advice and information. And you know, and at the end of the day too, all of our bodies are different. What one person's body needs, another person's body might reject or not need. And so I love that too, because also you don't know that something might help you until Scott jumps in and says, "Hey, I see what you're doing, but what if you did try this? Like, I'm just curious." And you know, worst case scenario, you give it a shot. Worst case scenario, it didn't work. Best case scenario, you now have a new tactic, a new tool in the tool belt, something that might help you long term. So
Right.
I love that too. So I definitely appreciate you jumping in too, because I get an opportunity to learn from people who have been around doing this longer than me. You know, whether it comes to recovery or to anything fitness related, I love learning from people who have paved the way and been doing this way longer than me, and almost been sober as long as I've been alive. Like, you say something, I'm probably going to take that suggestion pretty seriously.
I appreciate that. I appreciate there's no reason to learn things unless you're passing them on.
Sure.
I mean, you know, that's very self-centered way of doing things. Also, you know, about trying new things, you got to be a lifelong learner, right? You got to keep trying new things. And that's one of the nice things. I've always been blessed with curiosity. So that's really been a positive. I was on arthritis medicine, prescribed arthritis medicine. And when I got my hip replaced in 2015, I was doing a lot of research, and they talked about problems with meat causing joint inflammation. Well, you know, I'm sort of Buddhist and sort of, you know, a lot of other things, but so I decided to try that, and I was off medication in 3 weeks. Kathy again went all in on that with me, and I tell people I'm about 95% vegan and 100% plant-based. The rest is all vegetarian, but you know, when you go out to eat, it's pretty tough to stay
Yeah.
vegan all the time. So, but all, you know, I could play piano if I knew how, but you know,
I
my
just love
fingers,
the way you said that. I could play piano if I knew how.
my fingers would work, you know, and before they were just like, you know, they just wouldn't move very well. And, you know, it hurt when I ran and, you know, so I've got absolutely no joint inflammation now. And I've been vegetarian since 2015 and vegan for about, I actually made a decision to give up the eggs, give up the dairy, probably about a year ago. And so now, you know, I'm pretty much vegan, but yeah, you always got to learn. You got to be open to new ideas, be willing to try things. And I mean, what's the harm? You can always go back, you know, to doing
For
what you've
sure.
done before. So,
I've thought about it. I've said many times too that if I ever go vegan, I think the easiest thing to be to give up would be the dairy. I don't really care for milk much. I prefer when I'm making protein shakes at home, I prefer almond milk anyway. I don't really like butter. I mean, I try and avoid like you said, if I go out to eat, I'm not asking the chef to necessarily make any changes to my dish. They're making it how they're making it. If there's butter in it, fine, but I don't use any butter at home. I
right.
think the hardest thing for me, if I were to actually go vegan, would be eggs. I've said it all the time too. If I ever went vegan, I probably wouldn't be able to use the title because I mean, I know I could give up eggs, but I don't know if I would ever want to. Like, eggs are such a part of my diet. I eat hard boiled eggs for breakfast. I love eating. I put sunny side up eggs on like pretty much almost anything. Like just last night, my chef at the restaurant I work at made me a rice bowl, and the leftovers this morning I threw a sunny side up egg on the leftovers. Like I just love breaking egg yolk over everything. That would be by far the hardest thing for me to give up. I don't know if I could do it.
There's a product, if you don't mind me plugging it. It's a thing called Just Egg. Comes in a little yellow bottle, and it makes the best omelets in the world. It's plant-based. There's no egg in it,
Does it have
and
a yolk though? Because that's what I need. I need a yolk.
no, it's
That's
not. No, it looks like pre-scrambled egg,
okay. Yeah,
basically. But it makes great omelets. So there are alternatives out there. Well, they haven't figured out how to replicate the egg yolk and white yet.
I wouldn't even. I love the yolk. Like I said, I like breaking the yolk over things, and it's just like it adds that nice texture and that richness.
Sure.
And even when I eat a hard boiled egg, a lot of times too, like, you know, some people throw the yolk out and they eat the white. No, I eat the yolk by itself. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, Kathy does too, so I get it.
For the listeners out there that are hearing this podcast and they really need to hear something, for those that might be sick and suffering and they're looking to hear something to hopefully put the drink or the drug down, or for those that might be sober but struggling and thinking about picking up, what can you say to those listeners over the last 34 years that you've learned? What can you say that would help those either put the drink or the drug down or prevent them from picking one up today?
So one of the steps, one of the things that get a get I think gets a doesn't get enough attention is step 11, meditation. People tend to be slaves to thoughts. They think it and we do it, right? In the old days, I had no fuse. So it was like boom, it was like a reaction, you know, something goes wrong, something goes contrary to what I think it should be. It was like immediate reaction, immediate response. So what we learn in AA is to start taking some time, right? We learn to calm down, breathe, you know, just because you think it doesn't mean you have to do it. We're taught in step 10 and 11 to do a spot check inventory. Why am I upset? What is it I really want? you know, I do I really want to take that drink and know that, you know, the ramifications of that are going to be very bad? Probably not. So what is it I really want? Is it attention that I want? Is it, you know, am I hungry? What am I angry about? My first sponsor Tom used to say, how important is it really? You know, how important is it really? And of course, the question that he's really asking is it worth dying over? Is it worth taking the risk that this will be the time that you're dead? And no, nothing's worth that, right? Nothing is worth that. So we have to develop a process to see us through those moments, those dark moments. Our brain wants to tell us that the way it is the way it will always be. That is a lie. Time changes things. All you got to do is sit still and time will change things. Time will change how you feel. Those hormones, the anger hormones, all that stuff will clear out of your body if you breathe a little bit, take a few deep breaths. You know, it's a matter of, we teach people, you know, come up with a mantra, come up with a prayer, pick up a phone, take your anger to a meeting, you know, call your sponsor, pick up your big book and just stick your nose in it. I used to keep one in my desk at the paper in my early days. I had one the rest of my career there, but I'd take that big book up to the bathroom, and instead of getting angry at somebody, I would take that big book up in the bathroom and I'd open it up. I'd start to read it. And invariably something in that book would speak to how I felt and what I should do about it. So I'd come down and I may still not like the situation, but I wouldn't react the way that I had first thought that would be okay, because it wasn't okay. You know, so I calm down. So find a daily practice that works for you. Go to a meeting. Call your sponsor. Read your book. Work the steps. Pray and meditate and try and help somebody. There's only six things that we ask for you, right? Six. Go to a meeting. Read your big book. Work the steps. Talk to a sponsor. Pray and meditate. Try and help somebody. And if you do those things over and over and over again, they'll move from what you do to who you are. They'll become a lifestyle. They'll become your lifeboat. You won't even feel like getting out of it. Pretty soon it'll go from a lifeboat to a cruise ship. You'll feel like there's no wave that can throw you off course anymore. But you have to get through these early days. And I know they're hard. You know, there's no way around the fact that I created a lot of hell for a lot of people when I was drinking. When I get sober, you know, those waves are going to crest over me. There's going to be a lot of people that are going to still want a pound of flesh. And it's not going to feel good. But by going through that, getting to the other side of that, the seas will calm, you know. So you can look at it too. Smooth seas make poor sailors, you know. So, you know, that rough part, you start to learn how to work the steps in that rough part, you know. When things calm down, they get a lot easier to work. So hang in there. Trust the program, trust the steps, trust. You know, there are roadblocks to coming to AA meetings. You run into people you don't like, you know, they're sick people, you know, that's why they're there. So, you know, choose carefully who you hang out with, you know, read your book. Go to lots of meetings. Those faces that you see in those lots of meetings, those are going to be the people that you're going to be able to depend on, because they're going to be on the other side with you. They're going to make it. There's going to be a lot of people just passing through. Don't let them bug you. Don't let them bother you. Just keep coming, keep coming, keep coming. And you'll find You'll find a peace and a joy beyond understanding. And I'm not telling you anything that's not in the big book. I'm not trying to sell you a bill of goods. I'm just trying to point out that you read it in the book. It promises a new freedom and a new happiness. And then you look on this screen and you see two people that it's coming true for. So hang in there, you know, hang in there. And it does get better. It gets better and it gets better. And then it gets better and better and better. So.
Wow. That was just an unbelievable response. It was just breathtaking. It was, parts of it were giving me chills. You know, it's just, you know, you're hearing it here, ladies and gentlemen. 34 years of experience, strength, and hope. And that's exactly what Scott is bringing to the table for us. This young man has learned a lot along the way, and he's here to share some of that with us. So I know I'm enjoying a lot of it. I'm taking a lot of it in, things I'm going to listen to here, things I was able to really take from that. And you know, just like they say in the meetings, you know, we go, you listen, take what you need and leave the rest. And I know I'll be taking a lot from this today. That is for sure. But definitely want to thank you for sharing all of your experience, strength, and hope with us today. On behalf of all of our listeners on all of the platforms in every country that this podcast is getting downloads, again, Scott, we want to sincerely thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. It really has been a pleasure to get a chance to hear your story. Wishing you all the best in any of your future adventures. Definitely keep us posted when you get ready to do that track run, if and when it happens. I would love to get some information on that. But until then, just thank you again so much for being a part. All we ask from us to you, Scott, is that you continue staying healthy, continue staying fit. And my man, tell us how you're doing it.
One day at a time.
I love it. Absolutely love it.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Staying Fit ODAT. If you yourself identify as someone in recovery, whether it be from alcoholism, substance abuse, anxiety, depression, or any other type of mental health issue, then please join the group on Facebook at Staying Fit ODAAT, three different words. If you do not identify as someone in recovery, but you like everything we have going on and you want to continue staying in the loop with everything, then please follow us on Instagram at Staying Fit ODAAT. You can also email us with any questions, comments, or concerns at stayingfitodaat@gmail.com. Until next time, just know you're loved, continue staying healthy, continue staying fit, and please keep doing this one day at a time.